Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this live episode of The Compliance Guy. It is Monday, the 25th of September. And you may be wondering, why is Sean wearing a hat? Well, it is to celebrate the end of a miserable season for the Boston Red Sox, who were battling the New York Yankees, Scott Kraft's team, for who is going to be dead last in the American League East. So, as a tribute and a farewell to the Boston Red Sox of 2023, I am wearing my Durham Bulls hat. And if you have not seen the movie Bull Durham, you have missed out on a fantastic movie with Mr. LaRouche. So, I will leave that to all of y'all out there to figure out that movie and who LaRouche is. But with that said, I get to welcome my own cast of all-stars. Paul Spencer, Stephanie Howard, and Terry Fletcher. Christine Hall and Scott Kraft are out on assignment today. One of them's flying somewhere in Texas, and the other one's flying somewhere to New York or home. So we will be without them today. And before I get in trouble from the powers to be at the radio station, I'll take my hat off before I get yelled at. All right. So with that said, we have a great episode for y'all today. Extremely excited to have Paul, Stephanie, and Terry. I hope y'all have had a wonderful weekend. Had a great weekend. It was very busy, as always. But with that said, how is everybody?
Good.
Good, huh?
Yeah.
Good. Sorry. I take myself on mute. Forgot I was on mute. Yeah, good.
Okay. All right. So we have an abbreviated panel today, but let's see. We may go 30, 45 minutes today, or we may get a whole hour. But we've got five topics that I think I'd like to at least try to get to. And I want to start with Stephanie first. So I'm going to put you into the hot seat here, Stephanie. And I want to talk about orders and how certain EMRs impact where they are put, how they're translated, and the impact that these actually create on how much medical necessity can be provided back to a provider for these tests.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things I've seen recently. Last week, actually, I was doing an audit in the emergency department. So, you know, I feel like we've always had this issue in the ER where we work through, you know, not every chest pain's a 5, not every abdominal pain's a 4 or a 5. And we have to go through these constant reminders all of the time when we're auditing and educating. But one of the new issues that I'm seeing in the emergency department is that coders and sometimes providers are forgetting the fact that we can't use an entire chart when we're coding for the ER, for the professional side. There's a difference between billing for the facility in this situation and billing for the pro fee side. And one of the things that I'm finding is that if, for example, the patient is not admitted, and if there's a lack of detail in documentation, I can't get levels of service up sometimes even to a 4 and definitely not to a 5. And one of the things that I noticed this last time, and I'm not sure if it's something that's built into the way that templates are used in that setting. For example, I was working within Epic, and orders, for example, were not automatically blowing into a treatment plan. So what it was leaving is that when the physician was saying that they ordered labs, or they would just say the word pain control, it left me at a place where I couldn't do much with the information. In that situation, I think what was happening is that the coders for the department were going into the timeline that's typically laid out in that EMR system, where we can see notes from the nurses, the different tasks from the nurses. But we have to remember, we can't leave that document without that provider pretty much giving us a straight trail over to another part of the chart. So what that was leaving me with was patients who clearly were a high risk situation. And if I'm lucky, and Paul and Terry, I don't know how you feel about this, I go back and forth, you know, when they use the word labs, do we give credit for two because there was an S? Do we give credit for one? What is the payer auditor going to think if they're pulling these records? And then, you know, with pain control, we can't do anything with it. I don't know if that was Tylenol, ibuprofen, or narcotic, if it was given through an IV. There's not much we can do with that. So, you know, I fully expect that when that audit goes back, I'm going to get some pushback from the coding group, also from the physician. But we have to make sure that when we're validating information, that we're still following the proper steps and not going outside of the chart to grab information. One other thing before I kick it over, Terry and Paul. Sean, you had mentioned medical necessity, and that's another thing that I'm finding can be problematic as well when I'm working with groups that have more of their standing orders or verbal orders where something's just done and we can't see in the chart, you know, why that's done. It could be assumed, you know, a patient comes in with urinary complaints. We have the assumption that that's why the UA is done. But if all we see is a result, we don't see what's leading up to that. That could be problematic. And if we think about habits, that's going to create a bad habit within the practice as well. Okay, Paul or Terry, go ahead and take it away.
Well, is that okay, Paul, or do you want to chime in here?
Go right ahead, Terry.
Okay. So one of the things I see, and I think Stephanie's absolutely right, as far as when we have to deal with the tests or the orders and some of the generic statements that are put there that we're supposed to try to dissect and figure out how to give credit for that. But I think with the new guidelines, and I say new since 2021, what's probably the most difficult, especially in data points, that's where everybody's having the issues, because it's so easy to upcode incorrectly with data point information, is the fact that when we used to audit prior to 2021, for me, is that I only had to look at the note in front of me. I didn't have to look at past notes. But because the information now says that the order includes the result, the order includes the review, you can't double dip that information. And then even the clarification on what is an independent interpretation, where everyone's taking a very loose definition of that and trying to upcode to a moderate level when it's really a low level service, is very tough, because now we have to go back and figure out, okay, how many times is this doctor, this provider, trying to get credit for something they ordered months ago, you know, for something they already went over the test with the patient again months ago or at the last several visits. You can't keep getting credit for something that you already got credit for. And that's where it's really tough when it's not clear in the note. Also, and Sean and I were talking about this on a recent hashtag Terry Tuesday too, is that there's also a lot of general lifestyle comments in records that physicians are saying, yes, but I put a lifestyle in there that they should be eating green leafy vegetables. Doesn't that up the code? I'm like, are you kidding? Or that you should get your immunizations, or it's time for your your screening colonoscopy. I'm like, what does it have to do with the problems addressed? Zippo. So it's nice that you do that, but it has nothing to do with a problem-oriented visit computing to try and get you that level of service.
And I want to jump in. Yeah, I want to jump in for 1 second, and I want to give it to Paul for just 1 second. So for me, I am always trying to think about the defense side, right? And listen, my perspective, I always want people to be thinking proactively, right? You do things proactively so you don't have to defend yourself, so you don't have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal bills, right? Not only the bills, but the headache, the hassle, the what it does to your psyche, what it does to your reputation, all of these different things. So while I want providers to be proactive in thinking through their documentation, I need you to also communicate, those of you who are not physicians who are listening to us today, I need you to communicate to your providers, look, you've also got to think about things from a defensibility standpoint. Because even if you believe you're doing everything correctly and you're dotting your I's, you're crossing your T's, things are, you know, in your mind looking right, there's always someone looking to discredit that or looking for that hole in your documentation or looking for how they can downcode your services. So for me, I need people to think about defensibility. I need you to think about, God forbid, in the event you have to justify your billings, you have to justify your documentation, and you need somebody like myself to sit there and explain to a judge or a jury why this documentation substantiates the claims that were submitted for remuneration. I need you to look at it as an objective, independent person. Pretend you're peer reviewing one of your colleagues and look for what you would consider to be flaws. Take the blinders off. Stop thinking about, well, my documentation is great. No, sometimes it's not. And look at it from the perspective of, if I was called into court on a Med-Mal or on a False Claims Act, could my documentation be defended to the point where I'm acquitted or I'm found not guilty? And I know that's a tough pill to swallow, but that's the reality and the gravity of the current landscape that we live in. Folks, we are in a new era. We have been for the past rolling 12 months. This is a new era of extremely aggressive investigations and audits and very overzealous prosecutions. So think about doing things out of the gate correctly and being proactive, but also think about the back end of things to where, if God forbid you needed somebody to defend you, could they? And could they do it well without embarrassing themselves? All right, let me turn it over to Paul and get your take.
I have one other thing real quick on that, Sean.
Oh, go ahead.
You made me think about a situation I went through recently with my daughter. We had to go to the emergency department for some acute pain that she was having. Couldn't really figure out what was going on. So from there, you know, first of all, providers need to remember that patients have access to records. So we can go in, we can ask, we can get those. In our situation with my daughter, I had to go back to the emergency department, get all of the records because I went into the primary care afterwards. Then we had to see a GI specialist afterwards as well. So when I think about the detail in the notes of my daughter's record, which were very detailed, very specifically showed complaints, what that treating physician was thinking, what the differentials were, the tests, why they ordered the test, what the outcome was, what the instructions were. When I compare that to the audits I did last week, it's pretty laughable because the audits last week said patient has this pain, ordered labs and pain control, and that's all that I saw in some of those treatment plans. So that paints a very different picture, not only for what we talk about here from a compliance and billing perspective, but patients can see records. Patients may start questioning why they're billed a certain amount when all that is there is the little bit of information. And then also, what do you look like in the industry clinically to these other providers who are going through and also, you know, looking at the records, trying to figure out what's going on with the patient as well. Okay, I see Sean jumped off, but Paul, go ahead.
Well, thank you.
You have the little square.
Okay. Well, the first thing that I'd like to say is that, I mean, data, the world of data and really heavily auditing data, we're in a new era with that because as far as the old guidelines, the pre-2021 guidelines, when we were working on medical decision-making, it was maybe one time out of 100 that we really needed to rely on data to get to either a moderate or high level of complexity. It just didn't happen that often. You know, there were some providers who tried to stretch the truth a little bit, but we were able to climb those providers back off the ledge. Now, suddenly, with the new guidelines, providers are looking at data and saying, oh, I reviewed labs, check mark. Oh, I ordered labs, check mark. Oh, I independently reviewed this, check mark. It's not that easy. I understand that documentation is medical documentation from a clinical perspective already is not easy. And then we ask our providers to do something that kind of fits into a very narrow box that's been created by both the AMA and CMS, even though that box has widened a little bit. But it still calls for specifics. As specific as you are about the treatment that you provided your patient from a clinical standpoint, you need to be that specific as far as the interventions and the diagnostic indicators that you've ordered for that patient, for that patient's conditions. And you have to carry it over. There are some times when we're looking at a piece of documentation that it's not particularly easy to associate which lab went with which diagnosis, which medical test went with which diagnosis or condition, which symptom stands out as perhaps the reason for this particular laboratory test. Sean, that is my phone vibrating. Pardon my wife and her turbo texting. There needs to be some very focused attention on the data section and what that exactly entails. You can't get away with generalizations in the same way that you can't get away with generalizations when it comes to interventions ordered either. We have to know whether those interventions are still going on, particularly in a hospital setting. And we also have to know, what the root of that intervention is because it affects the complexity of that visit.
All right. I think that was a great first topic. So I want to move into our second topic today, because this is one that no matter how many cases you see, no matter how many stories you read, I just don't feel like folks, especially in medical practices and in medium size to large physician group practices, are taking this stuff as serious as they should. So, Terry, I'm going to turn this over to you, and then I'll kind of jump in with some of the OCR cases that I'm actually working on right now. So go ahead.
Well, I think it's something, especially since we're a compliance guy and talking about, trying to make sure that we're accurate and clear on what's going on from a compliance standpoint in our practices. I think we lose sight of the fact that it's not just about coding and billing. It's not just about OSHA. It's not just about making sure the physicians are doing things right. One of the things in this day and age is cybersecurity. And we kind of, I know it's a boring topic. I know people overlook it, but especially in some of the smaller practices, because they don't have a department specific that dedicates to that. I also know that a lot of practices, large and small, think that their IT department is their cybersecurity area. And that's not correct at all. They know how to run your system. They know how to get you back online, but do they know how to deal with cyber attacks? No. And one of the things it's because it's happened, it seems to be often more often than not to a couple of clients recently. I said, well, where's your security compliance manual? And they said, what are you talking about? I'm like, where you say, if this happens, what do we do? Or even What are you telling your staff when they're hired, new hires, existing hires, about passwords, about how to use things in the office? like tablets and phones. And, you know, I know not too many people use pagers anymore, but there's a lot of sharing of passwords. I just walked into an office recently where somebody said, "Oh, I forgot my password. Can I use yours?" She's like, "Sure." And now that's an open book. And so now you've got a problem. You've got patients sitting in the exam room where their chart is opened up. The doctor is asked to step out of the room for a second. And now you've got patients trying to delete information in their electronic chart because it's open and the patient and the physician again stepped out of the room. There isn't even a policy on, you know, again, how electronic devices should be used, an acceptable use policy, how records are supposed to be released to a patient. There's nobody that's really equipped to deal with cybersecurity or even HIPAA in a lot of practices. You know, when a new provider is added, a new iPad, a new phone, a new 3D printer, how about a waiting room TV? Everyone's on the same server. So there's the risk there. And one of the biggest risks right now, in my opinion, are remote workers. I see, oh my gosh. And Paul, I know you and I had a couple of comments about this. I have seen remote workers because we pivoted so quickly during the pandemic to send everybody home. They can work from home. So there's still remote workers working on their kitchen table. They don't have a dedicated office space. They have records out, laptops out, all these things. They don't have locked cabinets. You know, they have family at home looking at all the information. You know, I saw one gal that she needed to write her daughter a note for school and she didn't have a piece of paper. So she grabbed something she was working on and wrote the note on there. It turned out it was the front copy of an op report from a patient and sent it to school with the little girl, you know, with her daughter. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I think cybersecurity on the high tech level is one thing without a compliance manual. But I mean, I just gave you a low tech, you know, situation where, you know, HIPAA violations left and right and sharing passwords and not having a manual to talk about this or even a, you know, a direction for a new staff. You know, you can't share passwords. This is how we're going to add to our security manual because we have new employees. This is our protocols for remote workers. And, you know, I'll open it up to the panel. This is such a big problem and such a big issue. I can't even tell you how it's going to get even bigger as we continue to evolve with technology, as AI is taking over in a lot of spaces, as more providers are trying to find not shortcuts, but technological advances, the security issue is going to increase. So it's kind of a twofold here that it's important to move forward with technology, but it's also, you have to keep up with your security risk and understand that it's a risk. And I didn't even talk about, Sean, I don't know if you know a lot about this, but the hackers that are into that, you know, hack big systems, they were asking for, you know, Bitcoin ransom, you know, and then doing that kind of stuff or asking for money, monetary, you know, to let you have access to your records. They were destroying records for a while. Now they're not. Now they're like, well, we're just going to upload them to the cloud and let everybody see them, but we still want to get money. And so it's not like they're asking for money so that you get out of this security risk. No, they want you, you're still going to have it. It's now a breach, not a risk. And you still have to pay off just to access your information. So there's a lot of foreign bad actors out there and you have to be protected. And I'll send it up to anyone who wants to comment on that.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and jump in on this. So we deal with a lot of OCR, Office for Civil Rights matters, tied to breach notifications, violations within the privacy and security rule. I work with who I consider to be the godfather of privacy and security, Elliot Golding. He's probably one of the most brilliant attorneys I've ever worked with when it comes to such a specific topic like HIPAA. OCR is and has been extremely aggressive in going after organizations that have suffered a breach and failed to disclose. There are what is referred to as a mandatory reporting requirement. But there are some that don't require any reporting. So, for example, if an EMR company at the national level is hacked, as we saw with an EMR vendor not too long ago, it is up to that EMR vendor, as they did, to notify the attorney general in each of the states where they have clients, where their client files were impacted. It's not up to the individual provider. So the rules can be very convoluted. They can be very confusing. My suggestion is that you work with an attorney who is competent and highly educated and skilled in privacy and security. One of the first things that OCR is going to ask for is your policy on whatever the situation was that led to a breach. So in the example that Terry gave just a couple of moments ago, where the individual had handwritten a note for their child to take to school and didn't realize they wrote it on the front of an operative report, that's a mandatory disclosure to the patient. They have to be notified. And failure to do that becomes a reportable event to the Office for Civil Rights. And the fines are extremely expensive. The one thing that I see as a critical mistake made by a lot of entities, both large health systems, hospital networks, physician groups, large and small, is that they'll engage a consultant or they'll engage an attorney or a firm to build a HIPAA compliance manual for them. The problem is, unless you've done a gap analysis to figure out where the holes are in your process and to understand what regulations are versus what you're actually doing so that you could close those gaps, you're creating nothing more than a template, okay? The second critical mistake that I see individuals making at both the health system level, hospital network level, physician group level, is that they are failing to educate their employees. Folks, having a compliance plan is great. Not rolling it out and educating your staff is ridiculous. Because why are you spending the money to build a compliance plan if all it's going to do is sit in a binder, collect dust, and nobody's going to know what to do with it? Second thing that OCR is going to ask for is your risk assessment. When's the last time you did a risk assessment of your computer network to determine the vulnerabilities? You know, did you test your firewalls? Did you test your VPN? Did you test all of these different things? And the third thing that they're going to ask for, and these are in no specific order, is your corrective action plan. You have to build a cap anytime you submit a breach notification to the Office for Civil Rights, the same way that you have to when you submit a voluntary overpayment refund to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or you do an OIG self-disclosure. Both of them are going to want a corrective action plan. They want to understand the root cause of the problem. They want to understand how you became aware of the problem. They want to understand what you did to cure the problem. They want to see your certification statement to, you know, compliance going forward. And then they want the signature of the compliance officer and or the CEO. So again, HIPAA has teeth. We have a HIPAA police department. They are very good at what they're doing. They're very aggressive. And I will tell you, in supporting one of our clients who is wrapping up a 2-year resolution, boy, they kick everything back. And it's funny because we tell them, hey, we used OCR's specific guidance documents. And they're like, yeah, you shouldn't rely on that. And we're like, are you kidding me? Then why are you publishing it? So anyways, be cognizant of that stuff. All right. Paul, Stephanie, anything else that you want to add on to the HIPAA discussion?
I was just going to say quickly, and Sean, this is something that, you know, when I've been involved in security issues, it's through Sean. So kind of listening in more so from his thought process on everything. But one of the things that I take away that I find concerning from some of the clients we've had to work through this with is that they'll reference the size of the practice. You know, they'll say, well, but we're a small practice. We're supposed to look at this from a smaller perspective. We're not a large hospital facility. And I don't think that that is something that really is going to come into play here, because you have to be ready regardless. The hackers and whoever are not necessarily looking at it that way, as far as, oh, we're going to stay away from them. They're small. They're not a hospital. So, you know, it's something that everybody has to be aware of.
This is one of these times where size doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Just saying.
I'll just add that, you know, as it applies to HIPAA privacy and as it applies to HIPAA security and your compliance with it as an organization, you're only as strong as the weakest link. It requires ongoing training. It's not just a once a year type situation. I know that in many cases, when people write their compliance plan, what they do is they tend to say, okay, we'll do one group training a year, and that's that. But all it takes really is one email, and you know, and all of a sudden, somebody opens up that email link, and you've got a problem. It requires eternal vigilance as far as ongoing threats to your electronic system, and there are new systems being invented by some dirtbag in dark office in St. Petersburg somewhere that we haven't even seen yet that are sure to come down the pike. You just have to keep a constant ear to the ground and constant eyes on every person in your organization, every new person who is coming in, every person who's about to leave. You know, the security threat has to be regarded as the same no matter who it is.
And the final thing that I'll say about this is that I am dealing right now with as many privacy and security issues as I am OIG issues. I mean, it's unbelievable. And, you know, to Terry's point earlier, you know, these hackers, they're not just foreign bad actors. There are bad actors right here in our country. And let me tell you, most of them are like 10 to 13 year old kids with a laptop sitting in the basement in between breaking into a hospital's medical record system. They're playing some Xbox game. I was going to try to think. Oh, Halo. Is that? I'm probably dating myself.
Call of Duty now, Sean. Call of Duty.
Call of Duty. Okay. So, again, you know, it's funny because these kids today, it's like they pop out with a computer and a phone and, you know, each hand, and they are so computer and tech savvy, it's frightening. Go ahead, Terry. Any final thoughts on this one, since this was your topic?
No, I think, I think the biggest thing for me is the fact that everyone thinks this won't happen to them. They're just like, well, I read about it, but that's really a conspiracy theory. I have doctors telling me, well, that's not really true. It's just the government just trying to scare people. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, one of those same providers recently got hacked. And he ended up having to pay like $60,000 to try to get into his system, which they corrupted, by the way. And it's just a mess. And now it's costing him an excess of almost $400,000 to go back and have to get a new system, rebuild, find a security company, and all of that. And it's just, I think it's just, it reminds me of somebody saying, I'm never going to get audited. It's just like, really? It's not if, it's when. I'm not saying everyone's going to get a security attack, but we are in a new age. If you use Alexa and you ask a question, you use something that has access. If you're on TikTok, they have access to you in a foreign country. If you use anything that is digitally, you know, technology advanced, people are watching. I mean, how many of us get on shop online and even on our phone? And all of a sudden now, whatever we were searching for, whether it be that, you know, bottle of wine or that nice pair of shoes, now that's all you ever get are ads for shoes and wine. People are watching. So they know how to get in if you have automatic passwords on stuff. And I just really hope that this segment speaks to our listeners and, you know, people who hopefully pick up the podcast at some point, and realize that you need to be proactive on this. You need to have a heads up about this more than anything else, because you want to have access to your information and not compromise your patients.
All right. I think that was a fantastic segment. So I'm going to put Mr. Spencer back into the hot seat now. And I want to get into a topic that is, well, it has been and is, and it will continue to be an interesting conversation. And that's private equity and the impact that PE is having on the healthcare industry. And I think it's important to understand that PE is probably more widespread than what most folks actually realize. And it's because the healthcare industry is a $3.3 trillion with a T, $3.3 trillion industry. And, you know, in life, there's only a few things that are certain: death, taxes, and the need for medical care. So with that said, Paul, let's go ahead and jump in and let's talk about the latest thing that's going on in the state of Texas and what is being addressed down there and how it could potentially impact at the federal level.
Okay. Well, first I'll follow up on your comments that usually when it comes to large investments, money follows money. And as the gross domestic product of the United States, with the percentage of it being healthcare going higher and higher and higher, it was only a matter of time before the powers that be of Wall Street stopped going to small tech companies and trying to have IPOs and switch their focus to healthcare, where all the money is and where all the money continues to go. And we had an FTC lawsuit that was filed this week in the Southern District of Texas in Houston against a company called U.S. Anesthesia Partners. Now, this is a very large anesthesia group in the state of Texas. And what they've been accused of is over a period of years, under the umbrella of their private equity firm who runs this company called Welsh, Carson, Anderson & Stowe, a company with about a 50-year footprint in all aspects of healthcare, filing in and out of a number of different companies, which you can research on their website. They have accused them of basically monopolizing the Texas market, driving up prices, driving up reimbursement, and as an extension, driving up profits. Now, from a Medicare standpoint, being the fact that some of the payments for anesthesia care are fixed, that's something of a very tough argument to make. But as far as freedom of choice and, you know, the patient being aware of just who the owners of their medical providers are, and the footprint of private equity that's out there already in the healthcare space, some of this might be surprising to the typical patient when you put it forward. But understand that because there's so much money in healthcare, there is a lot of private equity. Another area that I find a ton of private equity in my research this year is the drug treatment industry. There are a number of facilities around the country and a number of systems around the country, you know, in the middle of an opioid epidemic, in the middle of a rural drug epidemic, where a number of treatment facilities have gone under the private equity umbrella. And we, understanding that drug use and drug addiction, you know, the disease that it is always going to be a problem in our society. But we tend to think of something like that, and we tend to think of medicine in general from an altruistic sense. I mean, we seem to see that there are a number of physicians who get into this with a combination of scientific curiosity and altruism, and there are some who get into it because of the money, and those are the ones that are usually getting in trouble. And now that we have such a large private equity footprint coming into the healthcare space, we have to really ask ourselves, is that a positive thing? And in the overall, if what they're going to be chasing more than anything else is profits.
Well, I think the same thing is happening in the telehealth and mental health space, Paul, in private equity. Since, you know, for those of us who've been doing this forever, 20 years ago, mental health services was not covered. And if it was covered, it was very minuscule. We had maybe 10 visits a year, and we knew what diagnoses to stay away from. I mean, you even talk about anxiety or depression, and the payers were like, no, you know, we don't cover that. And now it's such a free-for-all. And after the pandemic, which everybody still seems to think we're in, they, you know, it just seems like everyone wants everything covered, no matter what it is, no matter if it's medically indicated or not, or if it's necessary post-pandemic or not. But the mental health space is, I appreciate the fact that HHS and CMS have been working together to try and get not only private companies, but Medicare to cover screening for mental health and certain services that have to do with behavioral mental health. However, it's becoming a problem when it comes to encouraging people to say something they have that they don't. You know, I was just recently for a well check and to see my physician, and my follow-up questionnaire was ridiculous. It was about, you know, first of all, did you get in within 15 minutes? Did you see your doctor on time? Were you able to get your appointment when you needed it? And then there was 15 questions about mental health. Are you depressed? I'm like, well, first of all, that's none of your business. I put no. And secondly, it said, well, why not? It said, why are you not depressed? And I'm like, well, let me think about this for a second. And then it said, if you say yes, and I kept saying no, because I was getting mad, but I wasn't depressed. And then they just kept hammering it. And some of the questions kept going on saying, did you get services for depression? Did you get it for, you know, anxiety? Were you offered medication? Were you offered a screening? And I just couldn't believe this questionnaire. And I just felt like if any patient out there said yes, they were going to immediately send you into some kind of tunnel where somebody was going to come out and say, guess what? You're a mental health person now. Now we've got you. And oh my God, it was scary.
So for me, Terry.
Yeah.
So for me, I got to tell you, and putting on my investigator hat, right? For me, I start thinking about why are we continuously asking this question after this question after this question when somebody has indicated no, or asking, if you've said no, why are you not, right? It would lead me as an investigator to start to ask questions such as, what are their prescribing habits for certain antidepressants or anti-anxiety medications or ADHD medications? So I'd start there as an investigator to look to see, what are the prescribing habits? Are they prescribing for one more than they're prescribing for the others? Then I would want to start looking at their financial statements. And I'd want to start looking at personal records, and I'd want to see what kind of declarations were being made for any potential violation of the anti-kickback statutes. I would then start looking at mini mental screening exams or other mental examinations or biofeedback or whatever else that was being done. And I would start to look for aberrance. I'd start to look for an outlier. And I would try to figure out, number two, if this was a primary care doctor, and I understand primary care doctors do a lot of mental health, right? Why are they not sending these patients out to psychologists or psychiatrists as opposed to trying to manage these major depressive disorders themselves? And
they've been told that they can get payment for
these folks might get from they may not like. Go ahead.
They've been told they can get payment for screenings and you know, I see something that Taylor King just posted, and I appreciate that. She said, it just happened to us. She said her son had a reading evaluation done with a neuropsych. And they came back and said, okay, he has ADHD. Does he really though? No problem. I mean, I'm not a clinician right now, so I don't want to say no, but I'm saying most likely it would be hard to get a diagnosis from that, from having a reading evaluation is a better way to put that. But I just feel like if anybody walks into a doctor's office nowadays and says that they're, you know, mad about something, or says that, you know, their child is bugging them today. Sorry, my daughter, Or says that, or Sean's mom is texting him for something, or, you know, all of us are have any kind of frustration with anything. I mean, then all of a sudden you're a mental health case. I mean, and there's these people want to charge for it. And it just, to me, it's talking, not just excessiveness, but it's kind of instigating fraud. And I hate to use the F word, but to me, it's just starting to open a Pandora's box of things that are going to put, if somebody thinks you can do it, they're going to try it. They're going to try it. I mean, look how many providers are still billing incorrectly for telehealth. You know, I audit thousands of visits a month, and it's still showing a 60% error rate. It's awful. Well, but now with this Pandora's box of mental health, it scares me.
Anytime you have a new benefit for a service, what tends to happen is there's a doctor or a medical group that says there's a buck to be made here, and how can we add this to our bottom line? So this is when you start
such a great point, Paul.
You know, this is when you start getting surveyed to death. And I mean, you know, I'm getting really sick of surveys in general. Like, I went to buy milk at Meijer. It's like I got a customer service survey. It's like, what am I supposed to say? I laughed, I cried, I bought milk, I went home. You know, that was my experience.
Don't tell them that you were depressed.
Yeah. It's like, were you happy with your visit?
Yeah. You know, look, I wanted to say something about that for just a moment, right? Because at the end of the day, I think we all deal with our own demons, right? Anyone who says they've never been depressed is lying. Okay. Look, I have an 82-year-old mother who almost sent me off of the roller coaster about a week and a half ago. I had about a 10-minute meltdown where I had to figure out, how am I going to deal with my life? But it doesn't mean that I'm struggling with depression. It doesn't mean that I have an anxiety disorder. You know, I tend to bounce from topic to topic because I have 42 different client projects going on at a time. Doesn't mean I have ADHD, right? So I think, you know, one of the other things that I've realized over my career, and especially in the last probably decade now, it's obviously a very litigious industry. And what I've started to realize is that physicians have gotten to the point where patients, in their mind, believe that if they don't walk out of a doctor's visit with a script for a medication or an order for a laboratory test or an imaging service, that they're getting ripped off, that their doctor didn't do the best possible job for them that day. And let me tell you, I had a case last year, and it was a healthcare fraud case. And one of the questions that the prosecutor kept jumping on and harping on was, well, why didn't you prescribe these medications? Why didn't you order these tests? And this was just the opposite of what Paul, Stephanie, Terry, and I see on a daily basis from the insurance company saying, why did you order that drug? Why did you order so many tests? And the jury was starting to, and we were starting to see them maybe shifting and starting to nod their heads in agreement with the prosecutor. And I made the point to the jury that true medical decision-making isn't sitting down and putting pen to paper. It's a clinician using their judgment to make a determination as to whether or not they should order a test for a patient, whether something is medically appropriate, reasonable, and necessary. And I concluded my statement by saying, the hardest decision that a clinician will ever make is not giving a patient a script for a medication. The hardest decision they will ever make is not writing that order for a test. Why? Because they are using their clinical judgment to make a determination as to whether or not they should go down that rabbit hole. And that, I honestly believe, was one of many moments that kind of turned that jury around to going, oh, wait a minute now. Okay. We're talking about a term that we haven't heard yet, clinical judgment. Can you tell us more about what is clinical judgment? So, you know, again, I think there's so many valid points that are being made by the panel today. I want to move into the last of the topics, just based on the amount of time that we have. And to me, this is one that I hope everyone who's paying attention to this podcast today walks away and says, holy crap. I've got to be more aware. And I've got to understand this stuff. So what I'll share with you is about civil investigative demands. And if you're not familiar with what a CID is, it is known as a prosecutor's most powerful tool in their arsenal. This is the arrow in their quiver that they use to compel an individual or an entity to produce records or to compel them to provide oral testimony. A CID, when served upon an individual, becomes a major disruption, not only in your professional life, but in your personal life. Because when you are the subject of an investigation, the government is looking to make a determination as to whether or not you have any culpability, whether or not you were a co-conspirator, or if you go back to the conversation that, you know, we started with, you know, whether or not you aided and abetted in the filing of false claims. Well, I was the subject of a CID. And it took about 3 months for this process to work itself out. Now, some of you may be going, uh-oh, wait a minute. They call you the compliance guy, and you were served a CID? Yes, I was. Had nothing to do with me at the end of the day. But what I will tell you is that any individual, see, the big misperception is that a CID is only served on a physician, or it's only served on a clinician, or the CEO. And the fact is, I was a compliance officer for an organization. You could be an auditor for an organization. And what I will tell you is that the day you have an OIG agent show up at your place of work, or they show up at your house, or in my case, because I've done work with this OIG office, and they had enough respect for me to say, we don't want to embarrass you in front of your family, your friends, or your colleagues. So we're going to do this via email as long as you promise to respond. And I did. And I responded. But what I will tell you is, for 3 months of my life this year, it was the most difficult time I had ever gone through. Not because I did anything wrong. Just the opposite. I dotted the I's, I crossed the T's. I had paper trails to ensure that I did what was necessary to demonstrate a culture of compliance. But then your mind plays tricks on you, and you start to question yourself. Did I do everything that I could have? Did I do everything that I should have? Did I say something that would have given a false sense of them being able to do something that they did that they shouldn't have done because it was a misconstrued conversation? Well, it culminated with me having to provide oral testimony for 4 hours to a DCIS agent, to an OIG special investigator, and to an AUSA. I will tell you, they were incredibly respectful. They were incredibly kind to me. And I think they did their diligence before my oral testimony to understand who I was. And I don't say that to say who I am. I say that because I've given 30 years of my life to an industry that I love. And to be called to the carpet and potentially accused or made to feel as though I did something wrong was painful. And I share this with you because I want every single person who's listening to this podcast today to understand that no matter who you are, no matter what capacity you function in an organization, if a member of your organization becomes the target of the federal government, they will seek out other individuals as subjects to be compelled to either produce information or to provide oral testimony. Going through this process for me, I think has made me a better advocate than what I already was for physicians and for healthcare professionals. I believe it made me more compassionate and more empathetic to our clients. Paul, Stephanie can attest to how many clients reach out to us on a monthly basis who have been served a CID, and we assist. But me being the subject has forever changed my approach to how I support my clients. And I am an extremely transparent person, and I wanted to share my personal journey with all of you, because if anything, I want you to know that should you have to go down a dark alley, you have somebody that you can reach out to who's happy to try to talk you through the emotional roller coaster that you will go on. The best part of the last 3 months of my life was at the end of my oral testimony, where the prosecutor said to me, "Mr. Weiss, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your transparency. You will not be hearing from our office again." So, with that said, I want to open it up to our panel for some closing thoughts before we bid an adieu. So, Paul, as number one, I will let you go first.
Well, I can tell you that I have no closing thoughts with regard to civil investigative demands. However, you know, I still run into practices to this very day who are just bad at organizing incoming mail if there's not an EOB in it, or if it doesn't include something that's claim related. You know, you are a business. You need to pay attention to your business, even though it, the minutia of and the hassle factor of dealing with insurance companies takes up the bulk of your time. Read every piece of mail, particularly if it comes in an envelope that has CMS on it or has some type, you know, look for companies such as Covent Bridge or, you know, Safeguard Services. Look at your correspondence. I can't believe that we're still at this point in 2023, and it's those little oversights that get practices in a lot of trouble.
Excellent. Miss Fletcher.
Well, besides saying go Steelers, I think the the big takeaway here would probably be try to, and I know we do also have physicians and providers listening to the podcast and watching, try to get your providers to buy into the fact that just because they don't like what one of their consultants is telling them doesn't mean it's incorrect. It just means that we have your best interest at heart and we don't want you to go down a rabbit hole. So, you know, take all information into consideration before you only take the information that you want to hear that sounds good to you, and run with that. So if it's too much of a good thing, it might be too much of a good thing. Always remember that. Stephanie?
Yeah, so I was going to say something similar, Terry. You know, it's one of those things where when I complete an audit, I know my results going back are going to ruffle some feathers. I know people are going to be upset, but along those same lines, keep in mind that it's our job to come in and be critical. It's our job to help you improve, because a lot of times, you know, most of what we see and most of the clients we work with do not have any malintent whatsoever with what's being done. So when there's a finding there, you know, it's our job to come in and hopefully make this so that you can learn from the experience. You're learning with us. You're not learning with the government. You're not learning with the payer. And we're setting you up for a situation where you're hopefully getting fully reimbursed for everything you're doing and also securing the outcome if an outside audit is to occur. Does not mean we guarantee. It doesn't mean our audit will make it so you pass the next audit, but it's a learning situation to hopefully protect you in that way.
All right. And as I started the segment, bon voyage to the Boston Red Sox of 2023. I'm not sure where the Durham Bulls are, but I still think it's a great hat. All right. Terry Fletcher and I will be back tomorrow with what is sure to be a fantastic hashtag Terry Tuesday. I'm looking forward to it. Until then, I wish you all a great day. Remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.